Support for WMFE comes from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's worldwide campus, where highly ranked online degree programs offer the flexibility to learn what students want from wherever they are. More at erau.edu/worldwide.
If economic indicators are strong by many measures, then why are so many working Floridians still living paycheck to paycheck? We dive into that disconnect. You are listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. It's Thursday, February 26, 2026. Numbers released this week by the U.S. Department of Commerce Bureau of Economic Analysis show personal and disposable income increased, and the GDP that measures the total dollar value of everything produced in this country rose. Other indicators show a slower but stable labor market, and a slower rise in the inflation rate. At the State of the Union address Tuesday, President Trump praised his handling of the economy and blamed Democrats.
Their policies created the high prices. Our policies are rapidly ending them. We are doing really well. Those prices are plummeting downward. The price of eggs is down 60%, Madam Secretary, thank you. The cost of chicken, butter, fruit, hotels, automobiles, rent is lower today than when I took office by a lot. And even beef, which was very high, is starting to come down significantly. Just hold on a little while, we're getting it down.
So if the economy is so strong, then why doesn't it feel that way for so many Central Floridians? Ladera Royal, an educator at Orange County Public Schools and member of the American Federation of Teachers Union, shared some of the challenges he and his colleagues face.
We ourselves can no longer afford our own career. As it relates to affordable housing, there have been teachers who cannot literally afford where they work, where they teach. Some are driving 1 to 2 hours or even more to work. Imagine the cost of gas and other factors just to do that. Then we are told that in order to get our own apartment, we have to make 2.5 to 3 times the rent. Most educators do not make that if you know the cost of what Orlando and Orange County is. Then you add on top of that credit score. And so if you can't afford to pay certain things, of course, your credit scores drops. We have witnessed here locally teachers having to live in hotels, extended stays, having to get boarders in the home, having to add on extra roommates. And who at 40, 50, 60 years old, who are college degreed, multiple degreed, want roommates? As it relates to everyday needs, groceries, me, myself, personally know how it is to stand in the grocery line with my calculator on my phone, making sure that I add up everything correctly so I don't go over, alongside of putting extra things in my baskets. I know I have students who will come into my room who are hungry because they can't learn, right, if they did not eat the night before. This is real. It's still going on. We're having teachers who are having to go and give blood and to donate plasma, right, just to make ends meet on the weekends, along with grading and all the other paperwork that we have to do, having to go do Uber Eats and DoorDash just to make things suffice.
Ladera Royal spoke at an event last week in Orlando where the American Federation of Teachers announced results from a national survey of more than 7,500 union members of teachers, nurses, and other public service workers. Union leaders and members of the advocacy group Protect Borrowers said the results reflect an affordability crisis. 74% of survey respondents said they're living paycheck to paycheck, and 35% can't cover all of their monthly bills. Many reported using credit cards or short-term loans to cover the basics like rent, utilities, or medical care. Dennis Harriger, a retired OCPS school bus driver, spoke about his family's struggle with debt and affordability.
I've been on Jardiance for a long time. I have type 2 diabetes. And I was getting it for nothing through the company that has Jardiance. and I was paying nothing for it. As soon as I hit Medicare, boom, I started paying, and I've been paying ever since. I got it down to about $47 a month, which is good for some of the medications out there. Then this year, I paid in January $214 for a month's worth. This is the problem that seniors have. Plus, all my utilities have went up. My gas is still about the same, maybe a little bit lower. You know, we can't afford this. Right now, I'm in credit card debt because I have to keep my homeowner's insurance because I rent the lot I'm on. I have a mobile home, and I rent the lot. So they require me to keep homeowner's insurance. That's $308 a month. I have one car. I'm fixing to try to get a second car on the road so that I have another means of transportation if the first one breaks down. But that's just the problems that seniors are facing in this day and age under this presidency.
At that event, the American Federation of Teachers announced they're launching a 24/7 campaign to fight for affordability, including a debt navigator tool to support members. Signs of financial strain are showing up at Second Harvest Food Bank of Central Florida. They work with more than 800 local feeding partners. Second Harvest Director of Philanthropy Dan Samuels says they're distributing about 330,000 meals a day across Central Florida, which is up from about 300,000 a year ago.
So we are hearing from our feeding partners all across Central Florida that there is an increased and ongoing need for food assistance to help feed our families, our kids, our seniors during these challenging times. And I would say they're ongoing challenging times. These are families who may have been impacted by the government shutdown and are still working to get back on their feet. They might also be families that are dealing with the daily disaster of the car breaking down or the kid being sick and not being able to go to work. And as we enter these cold months and we have to turn on our heats at home, we also know our electric bills or our gas bills might also go up, causing an added expense that may not fit into somebody's normal budget. So what we're hearing is an ongoing, sustained increase in need across our network. Second Harvest on our website has a tool called our Food Finder, which is how we track where people might need food assistance and how they might access that food assistance. It's like Google Maps for food pantries, where you can go on and search for the closest food pantry near you in order to get food assistance. We have seen over the last month an average daily number of searches is 335 searches a day, which is a 10% increase over what we saw last month.
And other food banks are sounding the alarm after seeing a decline in donations. For all those families waiting in line for food, the economy doesn't feel so strong. That gap between what the numbers say and what people experience is something economists have been studying.
If you're very wealthy, the majority of your income is not earned through wages. It's earned through investments. If you're middle, lower income, and upper middle income, you're really making money from the wages or salaries that you earn. So it's a very different profile on both ends. That is also why you hear Republicans and Democrats say opposite things that are both true. So the one big beautiful bill, on the one hand, Democrats say, oh, it's huge tax breaks for Republicans. Well, it's absolutely true, because in terms of taxes on investments, tax breaks. Republicans say, oh, under the one big beautiful bill, wealthy Americans are paying more than ever before. And that's also true because the income tax is higher. So both are true, but they both mean very different things and have very different impacts, both on the taxpayers themselves and what they mean down the line.
Amanda Phelan, an associate professor at the University of Florida Warrington College of Business, explains the strain between the two and how experts describe this relationship as a K-shaped economy.
I think that when we look at the big picture, we see generally positive numbers. So the big picture, we see GDP growth. Big picture, we see lower unemployment rates, although GDP growth and unemployment rates are a little bit lower and higher than at the end of Biden's presidency, but within the same range. But if you open the box and really look inside, what you see is some pretty uneven distribution of the economic advantages that are reflected in the big picture. And it's basically what I think is a 20-80 split. And that's where the K-shaped economy comes in. Essentially, about the top 20% of income earners are driving 80% of the consumer spending. So what's really driving the robust overall economic growth is a slice of the one-fifth richest Americans. So if you're not upper class or upper middle class, then you're not spending like that. You're not driving that growth, and you're not feeling the growth in your own bank account.
So you said 80% of consumer spending comes from the top 20% of earners. So if most of the spending is coming from higher income households, does that make the economy look stronger in the data than it actually feels for what would be the majority of regular families, the middle or lower income?
Definitely. And that's why we call it the K-shaped economy, because we have at the top of the K, small group of people who are doing really well, and you know, they're spending more and they're feeling confident. And then the rest of folks are doing less well, and they're having more trouble spending, having more problems with grocery prices, utility prices. So we really see this bifurcation in the economy, kind of a hollowing out of the middle. As an economist who studies international economics and trade, that's something that really concerns me. Because if we look globally, historically, what really drives stable, strong economies is a stable and expanding middle class that spends a lot of money on everyday things, both that they need, whether it's education and childcare, or things that they want, whether it's entertainment or going on vacation or a vehicle. What I'm starting to see right now in the US economy is you've got a lot of growth happening at the top and not enough happening at the bottom and in the middle. So you think of it kind of like a Jenga tower. If you don't have the base in the middle of the tower where people are spending, then the whole tower comes crashing down.
Are there any policies that would turn things around?
So a lot of the policy changes that we would need to move away from the K-shaped economy are structural, big, and long-term. So for example, one of the reasons why we've seen increasing price pressure on middle and lower income people is because of something called corporate concentration. We have fewer companies today than we did 20, 30, 40 years ago. And when there's less competition in the marketplace, then the sellers have more power to set prices higher than the buyers do to demand lower prices. That's also true in the labor market. So when there are fewer employers, employers have more power to set wages than laborers do to negotiate for higher wages, whether it's individually or through a union. And union membership has dropped now to about 11%. So there are these big structural changes where large businesses have more market power to change prices and wages that are less favorable to the average consumer. You know, there's a big question about the billionaire tax. I actually think that we could get some very interesting answers about what to do effectively to change this in both New York City and California. Because we have right now in California, Governor Newsom, who wants to institute the one-time billionaire's tax. So if that does go through, we will be able to track what its impact is. Did it do what he said it would do? On the other coast, we have Mayor Mamdani. You know, he's a democratic socialist, so he's pushing a lot of government involvement and higher spending and higher taxes. So we'll get a chance to test his theories and see how well they work too.
When you look at consumer confidence, when people report feeling stressed about finances, is that based on how they feel in their mood, or does it correlate with these more concrete economic pressures?
I'm really glad you asked that question because it has changed significantly in the past decade. For those of us and those in your audience who are old enough to remember the 1992 presidential election, James Carville's famous line, "It's the economy, stupid." And at that time, if you felt like the economy was going poorly, you were going to vote for the challenger or the challenging party. If you felt like the economy was going well, you would vote for the incumbent or the incumbent party. So for many decades, how you felt about the economy, how you felt about your own pocketbook and bank account was a pretty good predictor of who you were going to vote for. What we started to see post-2016 is a complete reversal of that. Your perception of how the economy is doing depends upon the party that you belong to and the party that you support. So if you look at graphs of consumer sentiment, where it's divided out between Republicans, independents, and Democrats, you can see in 2020 and 2024 a very large and very evident shift. In 2020, Republicans are all of a sudden thinking the economy is terrible and Democrats think it's great. And then 2024, after Trump wins his second term, it's the opposite. We've gotten to a point where partisanship and partisan, maybe tribalism, is really predicting how we view what's happening around us, rather than what's happening around us pushing us into a particular party or political arena. Everything is polarized.
What are you watching in your research? What kind of indicators do you look to see how the economy is doing?
So I'm going to be looking at data coming in from the second and third quarters of this year. A lot of the government data that has come in the last couple of months and it's coming in right now was, I don't want to say tainted by, but problematic because of the government shutdown. When the government is shut down and when staff is short, it just means that the quality of the analysis is not going to be as high. The quality of the data gathered is not going to be as high. So once we get those surveys and the data analysis back to its regular course of action, I'm really going to be looking to see what happens at the level of GDP growth, unemployment, and inflation, headline level. But also, I'll want to see what's happening at the income level. So we can have consumer spending going up. We can have a massive GDP growth, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's reaching everybody. I keep seeing this 2080 number popping up again and again. If you look at our recovery from the Great Recession, after the Great Recession, 80% of our economic growth post-recession was concentrated in the 20% richest zip codes. So did our country recover from the Great Recession? It sure did, but only for about 20% of our zip codes. There were a lot of geographic areas that were left behind. So when I am looking to analyze data for the second and third quarters, it's really important for me to look beyond what the national headline number is. So I think it's really important for people who are trying to judge how the economy is doing to make sure that we are painting an adequately nuanced picture of all of the different moving parts that make up that headline number.
Amanda Phelan is an associate professor at the University of Florida Warrington College of Business. There's more ahead on Engage. Black History Month marks a century this year, but it didn't start as a celebration. We explore its origins and we'll learn how the fabrics used in quilting in Black communities for centuries tell stories of history and heritage. Subscribe to the Engage podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so every episode is sent to you.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Every week, the Florida Roundup brings its audience up to speed on all things Florida. The show is hosted by Tom Hudson, co-produced by WLRN in Miami and WUSF in Tampa, and airs Fridays at noon on Central Florida Public Media. This week, the show is hitting the road and coming to Orlando. We're talking to Tom about bringing the conversation to a live audience here at Central Florida Public Media Studios and some of the most pressing issues for our region. The Florida Roundup airs tomorrow at noon on Central Florida Public Media. Tom, the Florida Roundup typically broadcasts from the studios of WLRN in Miami. First question is, what brings you to Orlando?
Well, we're trying to chase the cold weather. That's what we're trying to get here in Central Florida, right? Now, we like to bring this show out of the studio and to the people. And of course, it's always so great to be able to meet the audience members and have a live program with live studio audience. The energy, of course, is just a lot different. But we also think it really gets to the heart of the program and the beating heart of what public media is, which is to be in the community, right? Have civil conversations about important issues and also fun issues in the community with those most affected. And so we started this kind of tour of Florida about a year or so ago. And believe it or not, we did the program from a zoo in Miami. That was a lot of fun with the peacocks and the flamingos squawking behind us. But we did Gainesville, we've done Jacksonville, and so now Orlando. So we're really excited to come to Orlando, talk about real important issues for Central Florida, and also have a lot of fun and have some terrific live music while we're there.
Starting with some of those important issues, we are in the middle of a dynamic legislative session. From your point of view covering the state, what are some of the policy issues impacting Floridians that you have your eye on?
Yeah, I think the biggest one is the property tax issue. That's what everybody is focused on in terms of just Florida residents. Certainly the potential impact for homeowners, for condominium owners, the potential negative impact for commercial property owners, if you've got a office lease, for instance, or if you're a renter, of course, big concerns about what the elimination of some or the reduction of some primary home and primary condominium property taxes may mean for Florida. And then, of course, right, what does that mean for the local governments that have come to count on those local taxes to pay for things like parks, like road repair, perhaps, you know, some other infrastructure and just basic amenities and services that residents have come to count on? Those questions, it's been shocking to me and surprising to me, which are really smart questions that we hear from the audience every time we talk about property taxes. But those questions are being put off by lawmakers. We'll answer those questions once we see what voters wind up choosing, if they choose anything, when it comes to the constitutional amendment in November. So it's really property taxes, property taxes, property taxes. The budget, of course, is important because a budget document is an expression of values for legislators. And I think also, as we are in this election year of 2026, what the Florida legislature may or may not do regarding redistricting of congressional districts. Now, the governor has called for a special session this spring to reconsider congressional district boundaries, and that's going to impact Central Florida as much as it'll impact South Florida as well. We've seen it happen in Texas. We've seen some triggers in California. We saw Indiana. Republicans in the Indiana State Senate turned back that effort. They did not redraw their districts. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. But those are kind of the three big issues, certainly, that that we hear from our audience.
This week, you're also going to be speaking with Orange County School Superintendent Maria Vasquez. OCPS is looking at closing 7 schools due to a decline in enrollment. In your reporting, is that a widespread trend? What are you seeing happening around the state?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's widespread in terms of the number of schools closing. Listen, if you're in a neighborhood school and your school is on that list, that's the school you care about, right? So that can be very concerning for those neighbors, for the parents, for the teachers of those schools. The number of schools that may close in Florida is not enormous, but a lot of school districts, particularly the larger school districts, are dealing with this. Orange County, where we'll be visiting in the Orlando area for the program on Friday, Miami-Dade, Broward County is experiencing this in South Florida. We've seen it in Hillsborough County and some other places. And it's driven by several forces. One is the previous expansion of school vouchers, allowing parents to essentially take the state tax dollars that would normally follow their child to a public school and instead redirect those to some other education choice that they're making, a private school or parochial school. We've seen in some areas thoughts that immigration enforcement has kept some school kids home. In some cases, hundreds, if not thousands of school kids are some of the estimates that we've heard about. Changing demographics of areas, right? That younger families are not necessarily moving in, not necessarily having as many kids. And that honestly gets to the affordability issue. And you know, that affordability issue is overriding the legislature, the political season, the election year, and yes, even kind of enrollment challenges that big school districts are experiencing.
So Central Florida is home to our Space Coast. UCF Space Czar Greg Autry, the university's Associate Provost for Space Commercialization and Strategy, was nominated by President Trump last year to serve as NASA's CFO. Can you speak to the wider implications for Florida's role in the national space industry?
Boy, it's at the center of it. We know there's certainly lots of activity in Texas, and there's some, you know, research and activity in California as well. But Florida is the historical and current, and certainly by any estimation, the future home of America's space program, of North America's space program. It was a record number of launches out of Florida last year, more than 100. We'll have to see what this year looks like, but we've already seen more than a dozen launches out of Cape Canaveral. The number of annual launches from the Sunshine State up into space has more than tripled in the last 5 years. That is bringing forth some familiar concerns about the environment, certainly with wetlands and estuaries and whatnot, but also a lot of attention, a lot of research money, good paying jobs, and a lot of focus on that economic development up and down the Space Coast. And let's face it, right? A lot of excitement too. I mean, the idea that a return to the moon and an eventual trip to Mars begins in Florida, you can't help but feel patriotic, feel proud of the state and the role that it has played in America's space program for now a couple of generations. And if not for anything, just the title Space Czar. I mean, how cool is that?
Something else kind of cool is that you're talking with Ricky Lee. He's a known voice in Orlando's Mills 50 community here and regionally known foodie. You're chatting about Central Florida life beyond the theme parks. Why was it important for you to include that perspective in your live show?
It was important because we're Floridians too, right? I've been in Florida now for 16 years. So not native Floridian, but I got plenty of sand between my toes. And so we know Florida in a different way than those folks that get off the plane in March at the airport and rent a car and then head out to the theme parks and have a great time. And the theme parks have their role. Certainly, it's important economic drivers. They're important in our communities. But we also want to appreciate Florida for Floridians. And that's why we invited Ricky. Let's talk about Central Florida. Let's talk about Orlando, beyond the mouse ears, beyond the superhero roller coasters, those things that we know our friends and family from up north, when they want to come visit us, they want to come to Orlando. Right? If they have kids of a certain age, or if they themselves are still kid-like of a certain age. But we know there's so much more to offer. There's a lot of culture. There's diaspora communities. There's great food. There's great fun. There's terrific music. But it's not necessarily always going to be in that travel brochure or wind up, I suppose, more appropriately, right, in your social media feeds.
The Florida Roundup is live at Central Florida Public Media Studios on Friday, February 27th. Tom Hudson is the host. Tom, thanks for joining us before your show.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. We'll see you on Friday.
This February marks 100 years since historian Carter G. Woodson initiated Black History Month in 1926. It actually started as a week-long observance in February that coincided with the birthdays of Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. It wasn't necessarily a celebration, though. It was a response to the exclusion of Black history. Harold Durrell Briscoe is Dean of Religious and Spiritual Life at Rollins College and author of the book, There's a Storm Coming, How the American Church Can Lead Through Times of Racial Crisis. Briscoe discusses the origins of Black History Month and what it means 100 years later.
I think it, as opposed to a celebration, I think it started more as a corrective. Today, we look at it as a celebration, and we are right to celebrate it. But from my readings of it and my understanding of history, Carter G. Woodson as a Harvard-trained historian, very clearly saw that Black history was systematically excluded from textbooks. That systematic exclusion reinforced racial hierarchy. And so I think for Woodson, I think he realizes that education is essential for racial justice. We got to think this is right around 1926. This is when the NAACP is at the forefront leading anti-lynching campaigns. This was when lynching was at an all-time high in America. Poll tax, voter disenfranchisement, all these things are happening. And Woodson's like a good doctor that goes beyond symptoms and actually tries to find the underlying root of an illness. I think Woodson's like part of the underlying condition and illness in America is the fact that Black history is not taught. It's not valued. And so we need to change that. In 1926, we see, you know, the implementation of kind of Negro History Week.
How did it go from a week to a month?
It evolved from a week to a month during the U.S. Bicentennial Celebration, which was officially recognized by Gerald Ford in 1976. Ford, a moderate Republican from Michigan, was very sympathetic to the idea of Black history. Now you've got kind of the legacy of the Civil Rights Movement. You're right in the middle of kind of the Black Power Movement. And you have, as schools desegregated across the South, but all across the U.S., you started to see Black students advocate for growth in Black studies programming in universities. So this is kind of occurring right here around 1976, when eventually evolved from a week into a month.
So if we go to today, 100 years later, what do you think Black History Month is supposed to be today? Is it about that accountability you mentioned? Is it a celebration? What is it?
I think that Black history is a beautiful tapestry and collection of the story of African Americans in the United States. That story is one of triumph and tragedy. The story projects the classic American value of resilience in the face of adversity. And so for me, Sharon, I think today, we're looking at 100 years of Black history. I think it is important to celebrate it as a story of resilience. And I think that there's been a concerted effort from a lot of folks that do not like, or maybe deem it as racially exclusive, or that it's based in this victimization. Right? Because a part of Black history, as I said before, is a story of tragedy. It is morally incumbent upon us as a nation to make space for this, to celebrate this, and to understand its continual impact on future generations.
If institutions don't preserve Black history, or if institutions didn't preserve Black history, how did families and communities hold on to it themselves?
Yeah. A couple of things. Number one, obviously, the oral traditions, passing down stories of slavery, stories of the Great Migration, leaving the South and forging new pathways to opportunities in the Midwest and in the Pacific Northwest and the Northeast. These are stories that I know from my family. My ancestors were enslaved in Guntown, Mississippi in the early 1800s. I know their names. I know their children that were taken away from them and sold, never to be seen again. I also know the story of my great-grandparents fleeing Mississippi at the height of lynching to find a better path. So I think a lot of it's oral tradition. Also, Sharon, a really beautiful thing occurred during the Roosevelt administration with the funding, the New Deal legislation and funding of the Federal Writers Project. A lot of people don't know about this, but it's just a beautiful story. The Federal Writers Project essentially funded people to go down south and across the country and to transcribe the stories of formerly enslaved persons. Thousands and thousands and thousands of stories were able to be kept and written down and codified into historical memory. This is like early 30s, 1930s. So folks born into slavery, I mean, they're getting a lot older. That generation is passing away. So luckily, the Federal Writers Project were able to preserve numerous stories that told of the African-American experience.
When we look at Black History Month today, what do you wish people better understood about it?
Today, 2026, there are like raging debates over curriculum, over divisive concepts, over what's appropriate to teach. Public universities across the country are axing African-American studies majors, classes. I want people to understand that historical memory shapes civic identity. Democracy requires honest reckoning. That's the beauty of, I think, about our constitutional republic, is that there is this transparency, there is this openness, and this commitment to work towards a more perfect union. So I think that, like, we have to understand that historical memory is a key part of our responsibility as civically engaged people. I truly believe that America has struggled with truly owning up to the deep ramifications and pain of its history towards African Americans and other marginalized groups of people. And I think because of that, I think we're still seeing some of the inequities and inequalities today. And so a nation that does not tell the truth about its past cannot build a just future. So that's why this is important.
Harold Durrell Briscoe is a Dean of Religious and Spiritual Life at Rollins College. What started as a means of survival during slavery evolved into an art form and a tool to preserve a family's legacy. We learn the history behind quilt making as a means of storytelling in Black communities. That's next on Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and lift off of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Quilting has played a significant role in the lives of people for centuries. During slavery, Black women were forced to make quilts from scraps to survive bitter, cold weather conditions. Later, quilting transformed into a form of expression and art. Today, that history is unfolding inside artist Lisa Moore's studio at the Art and History Museum's Maitland. The fabric being cut here is just one piece of the stories Lisa is stitching together.
So I'm just sewing these scraps that I'm making from smaller pieces to make larger pieces. And then I'll just use these for any upcoming projects that I have. A quilt is basically anything that's made up of three layers. A top layer, which is the quilt top itself, a batting, and then a backing. So that's the basis of a quilt. And then whatever you put on top of it, it just adds to it. This all starts out as a sketch, and then I transfer it, then I pick out my colors, and then I create the actual quilt. Like, that one started out as a sketch, and it's based on Zora Neale Hurston's time in Haiti. Because when she was in Haiti, she finished writing the book, Their Eyes Were Watching God.
The colors of the quilt pop off the white wall where it hangs toward the back of her studio space. The quilt's backdrop is a Haitian flag. The top is blue, that reminds you of the night sky. The bottom, a bold, vibrant red. Rays from a yellow sun are in the upper left corner. A Black African raffia tribal mask is near the center, surrounded by flowing, straw-like grass.
I wanted it to show movement, and so that's why I have this grass here.
Eatonville writer Zora Neale Hurston traveled to Haiti to research and write about voodoo. immersing yourself in ceremonies that celebrated the religion with song, dance, and other rituals.
If you look at it straight on, you can see a backbone, because typically during these ceremonies that there were two people in here. So this would be the head, and this backbone represents the backbones of the person that is behind the head, just sort of moving the back of the body. And then if you look in here, I hid little symbols. And because she finished writing, their eyes were watching God, I inserted a little eye in there. And then if you move the grass, you'll see other little things within the grass that sort of relate to that culture of voodoo and hoodoo, the studies that she did.
There's so much hidden.
And that's the point, is that I want you to, the closer you get to it, to say, oh, I didn't see that eye. Now I see the eye. Now I see that little voodoo doll that's in there. If you move it some more, there's like another eye hidden in there. And then there's a silhouette of the continent of Africa. The closer you get, I want you to be able to see all of the detail.
Quilting began close to home for Lisa. She initially made baby quilts.
Whoever was expecting, I knew them, I would send them a quilt. And then my brother-in-law suddenly passed away. And so after the service, I asked my sister, I said, I want to make each of the kids a quilt made out of their dad's clothes, because I had read about memory quilts and that kind of thing. So I asked her for clothes. So my niece had given her dad a pink and white striped seersucker shirt, a polo shirt, for Father's Day. And so I used that shirt in her quilt, which had pink and different shades of teal and white in it, because of the shirt that my sister had given me. And then one of my nephews, he had a quilt made out of his father's pajamas. He slept in them every night. And then another son got a quilt made out of some of his dress shirts. And something about that experience of making those quilts for my nieces, it just changed something in me. And I felt their connection to those clothes that once belonged to their dad.
What began as her way of comforting grieving family also became a way to preserve their memories. The fabric holds history.
Quilting does equal history, and just from historical perspective, but also from a sense of necessity.
When you are creating a quilt, are you consciously preserving history, or is it something that's more organic?
So I do make a conscious effort to preserve history, because I'm a teacher by training. And so that's important to me, to document history. But I sort of like the visual nature, because sometimes we are more visual than we are for someone to sit down and read a book.
Your heritage traces back to St. Augustine.
Yes.
Do those roots show up in what you create?
I'm working on a series right now that is related to my grandmother's great-grandfather in St. Augustine. And so this quilt over here represents that, because, you know, St. Augustine borders the St. John's River. And since the river was such a key part of their very existence up there, I wanted to have a map to just show that. So I'm going to embroider it and add more details to it. But yes, my family history dates back to 1743 with Antonio Proctor in St. Augustine. So this quilt will highlight him.
Lisa's quilts trace centuries of her own family history. The tradition itself dates back to a time when it wasn't art. It was about survival.
So there's a lot of history in the process of quilting when the enslaved did not have access to, you know, you couldn't go to a store and buy covering. And in the wintertime, you would need something to cover your bedding or whatever you slept on. So that was built out of that necessity of having to make your own bedding.
Practically, they provided warmth during slavery. How did it evolve into storytelling?
I think when the enslaved were making quilts, they were too involved with the day-to-day life to think this is going to be some long-standing art. They were using what they had. They used old clothes, they used whatever they could get their hands on. But I think as we have evolved and we were able to be more reflective and sort of look back, there have been a lot of quilts that have been made to do a snapshot of specific historical events. We progressed and we had more access to different supplies and that kind of thing and had more free time. The craft evolved from a utilitarian to more of an artistic form where people use that to express themselves.
Do people understand how important this is to storytelling?
I think after I have a conversation with them, they do understand. Because like I said, all of my quilts, they are centered around a story. And for instance, this quilt that's hanging on the wall, it has African print fabrics, but it also has silhouettes, which I absolutely love silhouettes. So this quilt shows or demonstrates my family, the women in my family. So they're living. There are five generations that are still alive, from my 99-year-old grandmother all the way down to my 6-year-old granddaughter. So for all of that, there's a woman alive in each generation between my grandmother and my granddaughter. And so one day that just hit me. I was like, wow, that doesn't happen a lot. Once I realized that, I was like, I've got to make a quilt to symbolize that with five generations being alive.
There are so many patterns and colors on this quilt. African prints, shapes, frames, warm earth tones.
The woman in the center, that would represent my grandmother. And the reason that I have her with the Bantu knots and the shells around her neck is because her grandparents were enslaved and she knew them. She knew her grandparents. She grew up with her grandparents. So that to me is pretty, very powerful, that to have someone that's still alive that knew an enslaved person. Yeah, so that's why she looks the way, her silhouette looks the way that it looks.
Do you ever think about your work living on, being passed down for generations?
That is the goal, that all of this will live and be viewed beyond me. So that's why I put so much work into it and effort into it, because I want someone to be able to see, it's like, oh yeah, that is about X, Y, and Z, and that is about our family, and that is, and have descriptions about it and documentation, pictures and that kind of thing about all of the quilts that I make. That is the goal. I would love to have all of this one day when I have a bigger collection and have it all bound into a book so that my family would be able to see, you know, the quilts that I've made and why I made them and why I thought it was important at that time to make them.
If someone is listening to us and mm-hmm. they have never thought of a quilt as a historical document, mm-hmm. what would you want them to understand after listening to our conversation?
That sometimes as families, we orally tell stories, and through the generations, some of the details can be lost. Whereas if it's documented on fabric or if it's documented in a book, the facts are the facts. And they were facts that were given from whoever were being interviewed and told that story. And so one of the things that I love about quilting is that it freezes history and time. It's a snapshot in time.
And with each stitch, Lisa is ensuring her family story isn't lost to time. Lisa Moore is a 2025-2026 studio artist at the Art and History Museum's Maitland. That's all for this week's edition of Engage. I'm Sharon Stone. Thank you for the company. NPR News is next.